BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm in downtown Philadelphia, doing what I do best on holiday, perusing secondhand bookshops and rummaging through precariously piled stacks for bargains. Book Trader, a bibliophile's paradise on Second Street, is a favourite haunt. Shelf upon dusty shelf of literary treasures, just waiting to be discovered. And as I browse the classical section upstairs, one book calls out to me, Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. As I stroll out of the shop, eagerly thumbing the pages of my new purchase, I see where a previous owner has marked a passage and smile to myself. It's from Book 2, the ancient Athenian statesman Pericles' magisterial funeral oration, a speech which has long inspired me. The famous line I love is underlined in thick red biro. Make up your minds that happiness depends on being free, and freedom depends on being courageous. Here in Philadelphia, those lines are particularly apposite and yet full of tragic irony. Whether it's Thucydides, James Baldwin, or Bob Marley, many great minds have attempted to articulate both what it means to be free and, once free, how best to utilize that freedom in pursuit of human happiness and flourishing. I'm sure that many descendants of enslaved African people in America, a land wholly consumed by the original sin of slavery, have thought long and hard about the Periclean correlation between happiness and freedom, and that between freedom and courage. And perhaps nowhere more so than here in Philadelphia, because of its strategic importance in the American psyche, where notions of liberty were so central to the city's role in gaining independence from Britain. And it is precisely this much-lauded notion of freedom and the rank hypocrisy the city has historically demonstrated when attached to people of African descent, which always riles me here in Philly, with delicious irony, the self-proclaimed city of brotherly love, and which makes me ruminative, taciturn, and downright apoplectic in equal measure. Having walked a few blocks, Thucydides still in one hand, I arrive outside the National Constitution Center with one question on my mind. How can a city at once so proud of the etymological derivation of its name, the same city which houses the Liberty Bell, the Benjamin Franklin Museum, and Betsy Ross, the flagmaker's house, the ostensible cradle of American democracy, possess a constitution which callously, barbarically, and systematically denied freedom to so many of its African-American inhabitants? Pennsylvania officially abolished slavery in 1780, but the last enslaved black people weren't finally freed until 1847. Where was the Periclean sagacity and nobility of spirit when it was needed here? Did America's founding fathers learn nothing from studying the classics? Studies which, if their name at Oxford is anything to go by, literae humaniores, are meant to render you more humane, not less. This is a city practically awash with neoclassical architecture, ostensibly inspired by the ideals of ancient Athens. And so I'm now heading to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, with its imposing eight symmetrical columns and portico reminiscent of the Parthenon, in need of some coruscating beauty with which to soothe my soul. Sorry to disappoint, but no, I don't run up the 72 stone rocky steps in front of the museum or raise my hands aloft in triumph like Sylvester Stallone did in the 1976 film. Truth to tell, I'm more of a Rambo man myself. But the view back along the wide, flag-lined, manicured expanses is invigorating, and at least I'm not out of breath when I get to the top. Inside, as the herds of tourists flock to genuflect at the cornucopia of Turners, Monets, Renoirs and Cezannes in this breathtaking collection, I make my own way around the museum, noticing as I do the mainly female and almost exclusively African-American members of staff who sit quietly in each gallery, invisible to the majority, seemingly at one with their thoughts. As I walk from room to room, We give each other the nod in the way that people of colour do here in majority white spaces. I strike up a conversation with Shanice, an attendant in her 30s, with a copper-coloured complexion, a blonde weave, and long acrylic nails, who effectively spends her days staring at great art for a living. Set against the overwhelmingly dead white male nature of the paintings hanging behind us on the walls, not to mention the overwhelmingly older white middle-class visitor demographic at the museum, the contrast between Shanice and her surroundings makes me keen to know more about her take on things. It transpires that she loves the burning of the House of Lords and Commons, a Turner magnum opus. She's never been to London, although she hopes to get there one day, but simply adores the painting's vibrant colours, which she thinks are remarkably beautiful. She would, she whispers conspiratorially, like to see more black visitors here. Attendants like Shanice are a hitherto overlooked source of wisdom about this city and its racial politics, and their daily lived experience is one which we would be foolish to ignore. Rocky isn't the only movie which is synonymous with Philly. The principal lens through which I have always viewed this city, and which defined my adolescence and left indelible imprints on my adult self, is that of Trading Places, the 1983 story of a smooth-talking black street hustler, played impeccably by Eddie Murphy, effectively swapping lives with Dan Aykroyd's insufferably pompous white patrician Wall Street broker for a $1 bet between rapacious plutocrats. In mooting the philosophical question of nature versus nurture, Trading Places still profoundly resonates with me. Are we genetically predisposed to our successes or failures in life? Breeding, Randolph, same as in racehorses, it's in the blood. Or are we merely products of our environment, at the fickle mercy of ever-changing circumstance? It's also a profound meditation, albeit one laced with trenchant humour, on what it means to be truly free. Does money provide that freedom, or enable us to buy it? Or does it actually end up enslaving and ultimately imprisoning us? My stomach is now audibly rumbling, so I head back to the city centre, to the famous indoor Reading Terminal Market, for some lunch. Maybe I'll have the Philly cheesesteak I've been craving since my arrival. Outside the market entrance, homeless men and women, almost exclusively African-American, congregate on the sidewalk, opening doors for office workers in the hope of some small change. One enterprising soul even drums on some makeshift pots, anything vaguely novel and entertaining, for a nickel or a quarter from a compassionate passerby. It's then that I hear a soft, rasping voice behind me. "Hey, brother, can you help a brother out? Can you spare a dollar, please? Thank you, brother. Have a nice day." With eyes redolent of pain and unmitigated defeat, poignantly announcing that he was once a contender, he stares through me, not at me. Feeling bad and wanting to help, I dig around in my pockets and give my interlocutor a few dollars in quarters. He smiles graciously and wanders off to try his luck elsewhere, deftly playing on either black fraternal solidarity, brother this, brother that, or, more often, on acute white middle-class guilt. I can't knock his hustle. I'd do exactly the same were I walking in his heavily scuffed, hole-ridden shoes. Dependent on the munificence of strangers, these men and women eke and scrape, ostracised by their unsavoury bodily odours and their crack-animated gesticulations. They don't have the luxury of anything to cushion their Dantean descent if they fall. What does freedom mean to them? Inside the market, Liberian Girl, an old Michael Jackson song, is playing on the radio as I eat my cheesesteak. That song has an unexpected connection to Philadelphia, and when I finished eating, my mood buoyed by my Epicurean repast, I take a moment to reflect on it. Because this city is home to a burgeoning Liberian community. The area around Woodland Avenue in southwest Philly has become known as Little Africa due to the 15,000 odd Liberians who now live there. Its streets are lined with homely African restaurants and small mom-and-pop grocery stores selling plantains, yams and cassava flour. Many of the Liberians here were casualties of war, fleeing brutal dictator Charles Taylor's despotic regime, and in Philadelphia found freedom again amidst the warm embrace of the black churches. Yet there's a historic irony here. These African migrants may have been refugees, but they were also returnees, of a kind. Descendants of those who established the country, flocking to a city whose population vigorously opposed it. You see, Liberia was officially founded in 1822 by a group called the American Colonization Society, a Back to Africa movement which supported the resettlement of free black people to the African continent. It was strongly resisted by many African Americans and abolitionists, including here in Philadelphia, those who viewed it as a neo-colonial scheme to defend slaveholding in America by ridding the nation of free black people. Nevertheless, emigration duly began, with some 54 Philadelphians among the founding settlers, and in 1847 it declared independence as the Republic of Liberia, taking its name from the Latin word liber, meaning free. Philadelphia's African-American community, of course, is much older. But it wasn't until the end of the 19th century that the great scholar and activist W.E.B. Du Bois, the first African-American to get a PhD from Harvard, in his groundbreaking study of the living conditions of the black community in the city's 7th Ward, declared that the Negro is here to stay. He was right. And today that history, whether it's of the black bourgeoisie and America's first black university fraternities, or the working class communities in West Philly, remember the Fresh Prince, in West Philadelphia, born and raised, is showcased by the African American Museum, downtown on the corner of Arch Street. Founded in 1976, the museum is a seminal expression of black pride and heritage, with a permanent collection charting both the vicissitudes and milestones of the city's African American communities, albeit housed in a brutalist concrete carapace. As I gaze up at the museum, the immortal final lines from Trading Places keep reverberating in my head. Looking good, Billy Ray! Feeling good, Lewis! Sadly, though, unlike in the film's uplifting denouement, from where I'm standing right now, Philly isn't looking that good. And the chronic, racialized street homeless situation, the city's endemic poverty and stark racial divide, is not making me feel good either. Despite the best efforts of the established, educated African-American middle class and the go-getting mercantile acumen of the newer Liberians, one could be forgiven for thinking that, at street level anyway, the Manichaean world of Trading Places, of black indigence and white affluence, in our heads, so thankfully early 80s, is in too many areas of this city still painfully prevalent. One has to wonder, has freedom, as a concept so valued, cherished, and longed for, failed many here? I have to admit, those lines by Thucydides don't feel so rousing now.